Hi everyone, I'm Claire Farrell, I'm one of the co-founders of Extinction Rebellion, and this is the first conversation in a new series. We're calling it News from a World in Flux. I'm joined by Dr. Charlie Gardner, a conservation scientist who's also been with Extinction Rebellion for a long time now. Today we're going to talk first about extreme weather events, net zero, and something that I think far few people have heard about, which is a terrifying plan from American Republicans to dismantle all climate legislation, make it impossible to put that back, and actually to dismantle the state itself. So that's a pretty out there plan. But let's start, Charlie, with extreme weather, implications this has got for climate policy. You've written a piece recently that's in Byline Times saying net zero is not nearly enough. So obviously we've got a lot of extreme weather happening around the world, and I'll just list a few things that are notable that are happening at the moment. Immense flooding in China, which I hadn't really seen until I was doing the research for this conversation. The scale of it, what's happening right now. Messages not to go outdoors in Iran, massive storms in the Middle East, hailstorms and ice in the street in Italy, and Germany with snowplows in the street in August in Germany, Indian heat wave, enormous floods, landslides, and a heat wave in the Andes, which is creating extremely high temperatures at really high altitude, and it's supposed to be the winter.
Extraordinary, isn't it? Just everywhere we look around the world, things are getting really, really extreme. And you know, lots of people are saying, you know, this summer of 2023 is going to go down in history for us extreme weather events. The thing is with these, everything that's happening now, is that it's happening at 1.2 degrees of heating, right? And our governments have said that the safe level of heating is 1.5. So obviously, you know, that's extremely blind to, you know, the suffering and death and destruction of property and infrastructure that's happening everywhere. So the way our governments have said we're going to reach our bad target of 1.5 degrees is we're going to decarbonize, we're going to reach net zero. And most countries around the world have set a net zero decarbonization date of 2050. Now there's two really, really massive problems with this idea of net zero by 2050. Obviously the first one, and this is something we've been talking about since forever, it's the timing. You know, what stopping by 2050 means is that we're going to carry on making it worse for another 27 years. You know, it's going to get worse and worse and worse as long as we are emitting. So this idea of just, you know, slowly grinding towards a halt in 27 years' time, it's dangerous. It's really dangerous. But the other problem with this net zero concept is it focuses only on our emissions. So the idea with net zero is you try and reduce emissions as much as you possibly can by decarbonizing, but there will be some residual emissions that you can't get rid of. So you will, you know, invest in sinks to absorb that extra carbon. So that could be, you know, more forests or restored mangroves, or it could be these magical technologies which don't exist yet, which, you know, we hope one day will be able to suck the carbon out of the air. This idea, though, that, you know, everything will be fine if we can just get to net zero, if we can just balance our emissions with our with what we're drawing out of the atmosphere, this is really dangerous because it's not actually emissions that count. It's the concentrations of these gases that are already in the atmosphere, and there's already too much of them in the atmosphere. So at the start of the Industrial Revolution, the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere was about 280 parts per million. As, you know, most of us know, it's now 420 parts per million, and that's a 50% increase. But the safe level is estimated at 350, like 70 parts per million less than it is now.
Which is why 350.org is called that, exactly, 350,
exactly,
right?
Exactly that, yeah.
When they launched that campaign, I don't think we hadn't hit 350 yet.
No, and that was the target we had to stay within at the time. Obviously, we've blown that out of the water. But the idea of net zero and continuing to emit until 2050 is dangerous because it means the concentrations in the atmosphere will get much, much higher. So they might get as high as 470 or even higher. And just, I don't know, we just have to look around. The evidence is there for all of us to see that we cannot make this situation worse. And yet, policy, yeah, global policy, our targets are saying we will continue making it worse until we reach 470 parts per million or more, and then we will stabilize it there. And this is wrong. Rather than slowly breaking towards zero and then stabilizing there, we need to be aiming for net negative. Mm. So slam on the brakes as quickly as possible, and then use all our carbon sinks to, you know, forests and oceans and wetlands to bring back those concentrations back down to safe levels. So, you know, really what we need to be making abundantly clear is that net zero is not nearly ambitious enough. Our safety is at stake. It is not enough. And yet, the political reality is that those that are opposed to decarbonisation are really strongly pushing this narrative that net zero is too much, like it's too fast and it'll be too expensive and it'll be too much hassle. And all these, you know, just nonsense excuses. And I just think it's really important for all of us, whenever we get the opportunity, to make this counter-narrative, to state the case that net zero is absolutely not enough.
Yeah, and so with the sort of narrative around this notion of net zero, I mean, I think a lot of people felt when XR sort of burst onto the scene and we did that sort of big push in 2018, 2019, and it, you know, was kind of serendipitously joined by a school strike movement, which was super impactful. And then you had Greta visit Parliament, talk to some of our MPs, motion by Jeremy Corbyn, you know, the Parliament declares it's a climate and ecological emergency and, you know, we have to deal with it. And you have this sort of notion of net zero being a big win by the Conservative Party going, we're the first country in the world with a net zero target. And, you know, obviously we came back and said, 2050, what are you talking about? But like, off the back of that, like, you know, it wasn't the right date, but everyone goes, but it was the right direction of travel and therefore it was helpful. It feels quite weird to me that you can have a party that will put out that into the world as like a major political success that's all thanks to them when it suits them, but will also put forward, you know, members of parliament and take advice from think tanks who are really conspiring to say that net zero is bullshit, it's too expensive, nobody wants it anyway. And then obviously you've got this sort of like quota of members of parliament who are actually unsure whether or not climate change is really happening. And, you know, if they could get away with it, they'd be full-blown denialists. So what do you do when you look at the reality of that sort of political conversation that's going, you know, on the one hand, we're proud of ourselves because we championed something that made everyone put a date on it. And on the other hand, we're going to carry on gaslighting you, saying, yeah, but maybe it's not real and maybe we don't really need to do it and maybe it's too expensive, maybe we shouldn't do it.
So there are different hypotheses. You know, some people have been saying that the swing against decarbonisation in this Tory government has been a result of a by-election, the hot political issue was the ULEZ, the ultra-low emission zone, which will have impacts on the vehicles people are able to use in town. So some people are saying that this is a political move to try and win votes by creating political polarisation against net zero. But that doesn't entirely make sense to me, because the polls are, you know, every poll you ever see is very, very clear that the people of the UK want decarbonisation rapidly. We're prepared to accept changes in order to make that happen, and it's So I find it very odd politically that the Tory party have swung against this, because it doesn't strike me as a vote winner. So if it's not a vote winner, then we need to consider other reasons why this might be the case. And I think we don't have to go to look much further than funding and the influence of highly influential think tanks, the think tanks in 55 Tufton Street, that they represent elite interests. They are funded by fossil fuel industry. They are, many of them, in fact, we don't even know who funds them. They will not publicly release details of who funds them. So we call this dark money. Lots of it's coming from the United States. And I think it's just an absolute corruption of any notion of democracy. The idea that these think tanks, which are essentially industry lobbyists, they take money from we literally don't know who, and they use that money to influence our government to make political decisions that are against our interests. It's absolutely shocking and scandalous. And of course, all the evidence out there, evidence is clear and it's all well documented, and yet we just seem to accept this situation where our political system has just been completely corrupted by private interests. And we think this is, we've seen this happen in the UK. For example, everyone will be aware of the anti-protest legislation. It's happening all over the world. Governments are cracking down on the rights to protest. But in the UK, this crackdown has been particularly hard. The anti-protest legislation that has been put in place was lifted pretty much wholesale from a report by a think tank called Policy Exchange. And we know that Policy Exchange takes money from fossil fuel companies. And yet they advise the government on how to suppress the legitimate and human right of protest and dissent. So this is the growing power of the fossil fuel industry over governance systems in our industrialized countries is really shocking. And we think it's bad in this country, but tell us about this report that's coming out of the USA.
Well, yeah, it's a perfect segue into it. So there's a plan which is called Project 2025, which has been brought forward by American political right, let's say. And it says, our goal is to assemble an army of aligned, vetted, trained and prepared conservatives to go to work on day one to deconstruct the administrative state. Which doesn't sound very conservative to me, to dismantle the entire state. But anyway, it's usually the kind of thing that they accuse, ragtag activists of. So basically what they're saying is it would seek to block the expansion of the electrical grid for wind and solar, slash funding for the EPA, shutter the energy department's renewable energy offices, prevent states from going to California's electric car standards, and give Republican state officials more power to regulate polluting industries. So it's basically been put together by policy experts, lobbyists, industry consultants, Trump administration officials. And if that gets enacted, it's going to halt the green energy transition, shift agencies towards nurturing fossil fuels, and also legislate against reversing any of that in the future. So it's really, it's extreme. And I think it's a terribly bold thing to say that you want to deconstruct the administrative state alongside also, do this. But so, people have been talking about this and going, okay, this is a bit scary. What does it mean? But it would definitely feel as, in my line of work, it would make me feel like, okay, so maybe, So maybe there's, you know, people often say there's not much you can do here. We're only 1% of emissions. Why don't you go to the China or the this or the that place where they're doing the real bad things? But it does feel like if you legislate this hard against like what needs to happen in the States, you know, doesn't it make you just think, right, okay, well, go and stock up on dried food and move as far north as I can go. Maybe that's it. Maybe I'm not protesting anymore. What, I mean, tell us what your reflections on it have been.
It's certainly worrying. It's not enough to make me stop the struggle so far. But I find it really interesting, actually, that they outright said, this is our battle plan.
Yeah.
Because to me, when you see, when I first heard of this, I thought, right, the fossil fuel industry has essentially declared war on humanity here. And then I opened the doc and they said it themselves. It was like literally the opening sentence. This is our battle plan. So it's just such an extreme example of how badly broken our political systems are. You know, so the fossil fuel industry first became aware of climate change in the late 50s and 60s. And obviously at that point, they had a decision to make. They, you know, they knew, they had the evidence that the products that they sold would lead to catastrophic climate change. And they, you know, they made a decision at that stage. They could have said, right, okay, we must transition to cleaner energies. Or they could say, right, well, you know, this climate change business, it's a threat to our industry in the future, but we're going to, you know, we're going to double down and keep pumping oil for as long as they can. And that was what they decided to do. To do that, they realized that they had to fight against any legislation that would force them to keep their oil and coal in the ground. In other words, they had to fight against any climate change legislation. And that's essentially what they've been doing for the last 50 years. And it's been this multi-pronged attack battle, really. So, you know, we all know about the denialism industry, how they sought to convince the public first that climate change wasn't happening, and then it was happening, but not caused by oil. And now they say, yeah, it's happening, but it's too expensive, it's too much of a hassle, or, you know, we'll fix it later. All these excuses to not act. So they've manipulated the public through think tanks, through the media. They manipulate the public through social media, big, you know, troll farms and stuff on social media, pumping out these denialist messages to make people think that lots of people don't believe in climate change. Because, you know, we're social animals. We do what other people do. And if lots of other people don't believe in it, then it might make us doubt. So they amplify these voices. Yeah. They create fake accounts to make us do it.
Well, there's just a report that I saw at the weekend about accounts that have been set up on particularly on Twitter to push anti-ULEZ sentiment and to not to put out misinformation, but to like game the algorithms. So this is like also another layer of it, right? Which I thought was quite interesting just to look at that as one way of like, you know, using bots and also just setting up multiple accounts. They've all got, you'll notice they've all got like no tweets. They've only got like replies and retweets. They're new-ish accounts. Yeah. They've got no real footprint on the platform. And you can find, I get them follow me, and you know they come into the replies on the social media channels of XR. You know, it's in layers, isn't it? It's people saying here's some false information, and then there's other things set up to perpetuate that and also to inflate these issues so they look very popular.
Yeah.
It looks like everyone's very in, you know, exercised about ULEZ, therefore you sort of whip it up and up and up.
Yeah.
And it strikes me that, you know, people on our side, if you like, are not in the business of like setting up bots to like, you know, to game those spaces. It does feel like we're sort of working at somewhat of a disadvantage. Do you know what I mean?
Massive disadvantage, because yeah, they don't play by the rules. They've got no interest in playing by rules. And of course, there's vast amounts of money behind it. So that's the one big prong of their war on us has been this disinformation. But the other big prong has been directly influencing our governments. And for a long time, that's just been like in old school ways, you know, political donations and political lobbying. And there's extraordinary amounts of money in this. So I don't have the data for the UK, but in the USA, on a typical year over the last few years, the oil and gas industry has given over $100 million to politicians directly in donations and spent another $100 million on political lobbying. So that's $200 million from just oil and gas, just in one country, just in the USA. And then, you know, that's just oil and gas. Add aviation and the motoring industry and the agribusiness industry and the beef barons and the agrochemicals. And, you know, all these industries are spending vast amounts of money on the people in charge to say, don't make up rules, don't put in place rules that will stop us getting, you know, doing what we do that makes it so profitable for us. And you know, these lobbyists have been hugely successful. That's why we don't have serious climate action and we don't have serious action on nature or plastics or anything else to this day. It's because of the power of corporate interests. And they've been lobbying, they've been donating money to politicians for a long time. But what's happening now is it's like next level. Like they're literally writing legislation and giving legislation wholesale to the politicians, basically saying, here are the laws you can enact when you're in power. This is, you know, this is what happened in the UK with Policy Exchange and our police crimes and sentencing bill and the Public Order Act. It's scary times when the most powerful people are directly able to influence governments in a way that we as citizens can't. And this is really important because, you know, one of the criticisms we often get as in the climate movement is people say, oh, but, you know, there are acceptable channels for you to raise your voice. Go and vote.
Yeah.
Go and write to your MP. But you know, if the legislation is literally being written by fossil fuel companies, writing to your MP is not going to help. Voting is not going to help when the entire media machine is, you know, built around convincing you not to vote for politicians that will put sustainability first, but politicians that will put growth and the economy first.
Yeah.
So like, I feel like my hands are tied, right? I've been told your way to have an influence, your way to make change is to go to the polling station every 4 years. But it doesn't work. We know it doesn't work. And I think a lot of people will be like, yeah, what the fuck? This is seriously, seriously wrong. Yeah.
Well, and sweet irony that, like, at the moment, I feel a lot of people are sharing clips of Margaret Thatcher, right, talking about how the climate is going to change, global warming is going to become a very serious problem, we have to tackle it properly, swiftly, you know, we have to be decisive and know that this is a serious matter and it needs dealing with. And so it's also, there's just something very hard for me sometimes to understand about how you could have a politician like her say that all those years before and then have people who are supposedly from the same team who later are going, oh, but it might not even be real, and they join in with all that shit. And it's like, I don't know, it's something very, it's hard to orientate yourself in the world, isn't it, when it's like, does make so little sense?
Yeah. Well, this lack of sense, this has been deliberately created. You know, the whole point of denying fossil fuels and pumping so many millions into this denialism industry is to make people be like, I don't know what's going on anymore, so I'm just going to disengage. But your point about Margaret Thatcher is a really important one, and Reagan was the same. In the 80s, climate change was a non-partisan issue. And of course, you know, It's a deeply conservative position. Wanting to keep all the great stuff we have is a fundamentally deeply conservative position. But what happened was that, you know, when Margaret Thatcher was saying that stuff, the fossil fuel industry hadn't yet pumped in their millions to muddy the waters. It hadn't yet become the wedge issue that they made it. If you look at the data from the 80s in the USA, when you look at the difference in belief in climate change, there was a really, really small difference in the 80s between the Republicans and the Democrats. It was a nonpartisan issue. Mm. Everybody felt the same. You look today, it's basically a political issue. Your feelings towards climate change are determined in the USA by your political tribe.
Yeah.
And increasingly in the UK as well. I saw a remarkable stat yesterday that something like 40% of hardcore conservatives in this country don't believe climate change because it's been so politicised. It's become the case that, you know, the fossil fuel industries have funded parties to the right of centre supported them into power. And media have played on this political affiliation. So you get right-wing media saying climate change isn't an issue, and you get the slightly left of centre media saying it is an issue. And this is obviously nonsensical. It's not a political issue. It's just fact. It's just the basic reality of the world we live in. This is happening. But again, it just shows the power of the fossil fuel industry to politicise this. So this really makes me worry the extent to which the political process hasn't, our governance systems are broken and they just don't represent us as citizens anymore. And I'm sure a lot of people will probably be quite shocked to hear this and might feel quite dispirited. This idea that our governments aren't looking out for us because they're looking out for private interest. So what can I do about it?
Well, that is what we've always been talking about from the beginning of XR. And I think that's definitely the idea that you can do politics differently, the idea that you can make decisions differently, the idea that, people could get together and make evidence-based decisions about what to do in the world, is probably the thing that I think has landed the least well out of all of Extinction Rebellion's intended sort of impact. So we were always saying that we think there's a different way to do politics. It's very tried and tested. You can look it up. It's called deliberative democracy. People sit in small groups around tables and talk about what to do, having been furnished with all the best available information on a topic. And the outcomes are that, fair and inclusive and representative. And so that is still something that I think needs to be more broadly discussed, particularly where we see that this has become such a big partisan divide. And we were quite lucky here in that, like in the old days, like you said, it was always actually, there was quite a lot of conservative voices on environmental policy, on Thatcher on climate, and so on. So, the Conservative Party could say, historically, they've done some things for the environment that were world leading and da da da. And they love to sort of wheel those things out. But now it is becoming, the culture war is just denigrating our political discourse to the point where, politics is basically sounds like the Daily Mail, basically. It's no difference between the rhetoric of the Prime Minister and the rhetoric of the tabloid media, to my mind, right now. And so that means it is becoming more and more and more like a partisan split and this sort of unhinged kind of, I'm going to go after all our oil and gas because I don't know why, I don't understand why. But it's clear, these people are not going to deal with the problems at hand. And obviously, if you are going to work your way beyond the blockages of all the lobbyists and all the money and all the darkness that's there, then, the thing that can square up to that is something that says this is democratic. We haven't got anything else to use because we don't have that collateral to meet them on their terms with money and, bad behaviour and lies and all of that. So, the idea of having assemblies that come together, ordinary citizens, make decisions about what should be done, and it's got 100 random people in it that say, you can always see someone in there that's like you, basically. It's representative of the country based on age, socioeconomic background, race, gender, whatever else you want to put in there. And that means that there's somebody in that room who's like you, who's advocating for something like you. So that would be my advice to people, is to join local XR groups, donate to Extinction Rebellion, support people like Just Stop Oil, get out and get active and get involved in people who are fighting the good fight. But also, please go and learn about other ways to do democracy, because our democracies all over the world are in decline. And we've always been advocating that you need more and not less. And that message hasn't landed strongly enough. So please go and look up deliberative democracy and learn about ways that we could be resuscitating our democracy rather than just watching it get killed, basically.
I was going to say die, but you're absolutely right. Get killed. This is not a passive thing that's just happening. This is being done to us deliberately. And we need to stand up and yeah, fight back against it.
Thanks, Charlie.
Lovely to speak to you.